Welcome to the Sunstone Podcast, everyone, where there is always more than one way to Mormon. I'm Stephen Carter, and I'm here to be your host for this episode. So a few weeks ago at an Elders Quorum meeting, the guy sitting next to me said that when he goes to his favorite store in New York, he always makes sure to buy white Sunday shirts. It's essential to have white shirts for church, he said. It's symbolic. I looked around and realized that out of the 30 men in the room, I was the only one not wearing a white shirt. So Sunstone columnist D. Jeff Burton calls people like us, the not-quite-white shirts, borderlanders. We're not in the center of the church, but neither are we outside. We're no Alma, but neither are we Korihor. So, who are we? I'd say we're something like Zenith. You remember that guy. He led a group of people back to the land of Nephi to see if they could repopulate it. He explored the borders, hoping to expand the possibilities of being a Nephite. Yeah, I know what you're thinking. Zenith's experiment only worked out for a little while. Things eventually went south. Cough, King Noah, cough. But remember that Alma, one of the great prophets of the Book of Mormon, also came from Zenith's settlement. In other words, even though they're not perfect, borderlanders are important. They show us that there really is more than one way to Mormon. I think that's one of the reasons Sunstone symposiums, podcasts, and publications are always so compelling. The participants bring in a constant flow of new possibilities. Sunstone is like a ward where all shirt colors are welcome, even white. So, like Zenith, there are a lot of Mormons heading out on faith journeys these days, and Sunstone's mission is to support them. Help us prepare for this new year and its new journeys by donating today. Anything helps, even just the cost of one white shirt. Head over to sunstone.org/donate. Thanks. I grew up during the 80s. That was when Van Halen was the coolest rock band ever. That was when I wore moon boots. That was when my most exciting Christmas ever was when I got a Castle Grayskull playset and a bunch of He-Man figures. That was when I knew the Mormon Church was true because its buildings had the biggest satellite receivers. So, when I was a teenager, I stumbled across this book in the library called Jay's Journal. Its cover, which featured the shadowy image of a teen boy's face, promised, and I quote, "A troubled boy's descent into drugs, Satanism, and suicide." How could I pass that up? I'd heard, you know, that Satan stuff was going around Utah Valley, especially in the old Brigham Young Academy building in Provo. And here, apparently, was a journal by a boy who was actually a part of it all. So I checked it out, went home, stole into my bedroom, and all the tingle, started to read. I figured out very quickly that Jay was a Mormon. I could tell because he talked about getting ready for a mission, the Gadianton robbers and the three Nephites, and he obviously lived somewhere in Utah Valley. Fascinated, I read as this ordinary high school kid went down the path of darkness. Starting out, just as my Sunday school teacher had warned me, little by little. You know, just taking up a little meditation to begin with, then making someone's head itch with the power of his mind. But before the end, Jay was out at night chopping up cows and drinking their blood. He even got in on an orgy. And by the end, Jay had been possessed by a demon named Raoul. The book had quite an effect on me. See, I was a good Mormon kid. And you know how Mormonism is with Satan. He's real, right? Demons are real. There are even instructions in the Doctrine and Covenants on how to tell whether a spirit is evil or not. So when I read a book about a guy who lived not 20 miles from where I was growing up, who had gotten into the occult, been possessed, and even committed suicide over it, I don't think I slept with the lights off for the next couple months. Now fast forward to 2022. a book comes out called Unmask Alice, LSD, Satanic Panic, and the Imposter Behind the World's Most Notorious Diaries by Rick Emerson. And in it, I find out that the person behind Jay's journal was a Mormon herself. In fact, I find out that she was also behind the book Go Ask Alice, which was a diary of a teenage drug addict, which I had also read as a teenager. Now, according to Unmask Alice, these two diaries were a lot more complicated than I had known as a teenager. And the author behind them was a lot more complicated, too. So this is how Rick Emerson, the author of Unmask Alice, sets the scene. It was the late 1960s, and there was a lot of controversy about psychedelics. At first, you know, they'd held a lot of promise as a therapeutic drug, but soon the press had connected them with suicides, the Manson murders, and other really horrible things. And then the actor Ark Linkletter's daughter died, apparently by suicide, and he blamed it on LSD and started on this national campaign against psychedelics and drugs in general with the help of then-President Richard Nixon. So one day, Art Linkletter's agent received a query from a woman named Beatrice Sparks, and she said that she had the diary of a real-life teenage girl who fell into drug addiction and, after many attempts to recuperate and many relapses, died. Linkletter was interested. But who was Beatrice Sparks? At the time, Beatrice Sparks was a 50-year-old woman who was the definition of pulling yourself up by your bootstraps. See, she was born in 1917 and raised in Logan, Utah, in a Mormon family, and she was a teenager when the Great Depression hit, and her father left the family. So she dropped out of school and spent 2 years taking care of her family, much as a mother would. When she was 17, she ran away from home to San Francisco. And there, she met Laverne Sparks, who was, well, with a name like that, how could he be anything else? Also a Mormon. So they got married, and they took in Beatrice's younger sister to raise. And after a few false starts, they finally were able to make enough money to survive, and then really to thrive. You see, like, when they moved to Provo, they bought this gigantic 16-room house with 6 two-story pillars out front. And they both became pillars of the community themselves. Beatrice Sparks becoming the president of the Republican Women's Club of Provo. So, you know, they were a true rags-to-riches story. And all this time, Sparks was using the bootstrap method to make headway as an author. She wrote advice columns for a short-lived comic book, a script for the Hanna-Barbera Company, which, as you may remember, made the Scooby-Doo and Jetsons cartoons, and she wrote a play. But none of them really took off. However, being the civic-minded person she was, and also because she had an interest in psychology, she volunteered in veterans' hospitals in Los Angeles and at the Utah State Hospital in Provo, which had a teen psychiatric unit. According to Emerson, her duties were apparently, quote, mending and sorting clothing, providing evening entertainment, and assisting teens with homework, unquote. So, in 1970, she was volunteering at the BYU Youth Academy, which sounded like an early version of today's EFY conferences. One girl, whom Emerson names Brenda, had a breakdown at the conference, and Sparks was called in to settle her down. And she did. Sparks was apparently a really charismatic person. Now, Brenda turned out to be quite a wild card at the conference, telling stories in her classes and to her roommate about drugs and her sex life and other things that were definitely not part of a wholesome Mormon life. So after the conference, Brenda, her roommate, and Sparks all kept in contact through letters until, after a few months, the roommate was actually forced by her parents to cut off her contact with Brenda, who was becoming increasingly volatile. And it was at this point that Sparks sent off her query to Art Linkletter. Teen girl, drug abuse, a downward spiral, death. All from the diary of a girl she had met at a BYU youth conference. Now, if you've read Go Ask Alice, you know that the early and late parts of it are written in a bound book. But some of the middle entries are written on, like, scraps of paper that Alice carries around with her, apparently along with a pencil, as she travels from one drug-induced fugue to another across the west coast of the United States. And that's apparently what Sparks delivered to her editor. According to Emerson, quote, "Scraps of random papers and pieces torn from grocery bags, plus a bunch of diary pages, all shoved into a large paper sack," unquote. It was apparently largely up to the editor to assemble the book. And as she did, again, according to Emerson, quote, "she took it home and started reading. Before long, she was convinced, mostly. The diary felt true, no question. This, she thought, is something special," unquote. And indeed, when Go Ask Alice was published, it was presented to the world with a front cover that said, "A Real Diary," and it met with almost universal acclaim. Most of the reviews of the book said something along the lines of, "All teenagers and all parents should read this terrifying book." The book, it sold so quickly that the publisher couldn't print copies fast enough to meet the demand. And the reason it was such a phenomenon? It was true. The story really happened. Every fear that American culture had about drugs was played out intimately in front of them. So by the present day, like today, the book has sold 6 million copies. Now, just to put that into perspective, one of Stephen King's most popular books, The Stand, has sold 4.5 million copies. Sparks outsold King. I have to admit, I was curious. I didn't remember a thing about Go Ask Alice. You know, I'd read it like 30 years ago. So I girded up my loins and actually read the book myself to see what all the fuss was about. I'll admit I was expecting something full of, you know, overwrought language, morals and warnings and tabloid-style events. And it was! But it was also brilliant! I'll admit that I was a bit bored for like the first third, since so much of it was, you know, about the mundanities of a high school girl's life in the late 1960s. But it provided a baseline of, you know, stable teenage life to compare the rest of the book to, and once it got going, it got going. The thing that intrigued me the most was what a poetic case Alice makes for drugs at the beginning. You know, some friends slip her some LSD in her soda during a party, and she goes on a trip. And when she feels a sheepskin rug with her feet, she says, quote, "I remember trying desperately to give a dissertation upon the phenomena of each individual hair having perfect pitch within itself," unquote. And then a little later she says, quote, "I was even now, in my new time's length, living the lives of 1,000 men in the space of hours," unquote. It actually kind of makes an LSD trip sound mystical and even wholesome. Even the few trips after that are just as groovy. Of course, things go south after that, but at the beginning, the book is willing to give psychedelics their due. And then Alice goes on quite an adventure. She has an affair with her dealer, which is an experience she describes as, quote, "lightning, rainbows, and springtime," unquote. She sells drugs to elementary school kids. She runs away with a friend to San Francisco, where they live in what she calls a, quote, "whoring little spider hole," unquote. But they also start their own boutique and make some money for a while. Then she goes back home, vowing to clean up her act. But then she ends up homeless in Oregon, going from one fix to the next. She comes home again, falls in love with one of her father's college students, starts cleaning up her life, and then winds up in a mental hospital after this freaky psychotic breakdown after someone, again, spikes her drink. She gets out, makes headway toward cleaning herself up, draws up beautiful plans for her future, and then suddenly dies of drug overdose. Whether it was an accidental suicide or murder, the book leaves it tantalizingly unclear. So I've got to admit, it's a real page-turner. The diary entry approach makes it all feel intimate and raw, and the brevity of the entries gives you that little dopamine shot, you know, that you get with social media that makes it so addictive, bouncing you effortlessly from one entry to the next. And the writing has sweet little bursts of poetic phrasing that sound like they come from a teenager. Though she doesn't quote her directly, Emerson says that Ellen Violet, who was the person who wrote the screenplay for the television movie of Go Ask Alice, said, quote, "There was something familiar about this girl. Violet understood her. It was all those live-wire emotions, the strange, powerful hunger, and the crippling isolation," unquote. So, I must admit, it really is a brilliant piece of narrative work. But what do you do after you outsell Stephen King? Yeah, I know, he didn't publish his first book until 1974. I'm just using him as a sales benchmark. But how do you follow that up? So Sparks, she put together a book full of interviews with teens called Voices, but it was apparently a disaster. But then, a woman from Pleasant Grove, just a few miles from where Sparks lived, contacted her and said that she had a journal from her son Alden, who had committed suicide. And when she found out that Sparks was behind Go Ask Alice, she wondered if the journal might help dissuade other teens from committing suicide. So Sparks, she accepted the journal, and she told this grieving mother that she would let her see the book before it went to the publishers. And then, Jay's journal came out. It was based on Alden's journal, but with a few tweaks. Namely, a whole bunch of new journal entries interspersed throughout that detail how he gets into the occult and how his involvement in Satanism leads to his suicide. They were completely and utterly fabricated. And no, Alden's mother did not get to see the book before it went to press. Some members of Alden's family wanted to sue Sparks, but his parents decided against it. So the book went unchallenged. It turned out to be a huge sensation as well. As Emerson tells it, the rate of teen suicide had skyrocketed over the past few years, and it was especially prevalent among boys, like a 5-to-1 type of thing. Jay's journal seemed to show what had happened. It was Satanism. Jay's journal became a huge part of what we now call the Satanic Panic. Anyone who lived through the 80s remembers what a huge deal this was. Unmask Alice goes over how people were freaked out about Dungeons and Dragons luring teens into the occult. And you may remember the court cases from that time where psychologists came forward with children claiming that various Mormon ecclesiastical leaders had abused them in satanic rituals. This is a whole big thing that we certainly can't get into here. But Unmask Alice definitely gets into it for all you Satanophiles out there. But now that Jay's journal was known to have outright forgery in it, it cast suspicion on Go Ask Alice, too. And indeed, the more you look at Alice, the more oddities you see. For example, isn't it odd that much of the action takes place in San Francisco, where Sparks spent some time as a runaway youth? Isn't it odd that Alice includes statistics on teen drug use rates in one of her entries? Isn't it odd that Sparks delivered this manuscript to her publisher just a few months after meeting Brenda, the girl who supposedly wrote the diary? And finally, isn't it odd that Brenda is still alive? Yep, Emerson tracks her down, and she's still kicking. So, you know, it's possible that Brenda sent Sparks her diary. It's possible that Brenda really did keep all those scraps of paper she kept her diary on while she was stoned and homeless in Oregon, but we have zero records on that. We only have Sparks' word. There were apparently no documents connected to the original Go Ask Alice material anywhere in the Beatrice Sparks boxes in the L. Tom Perry archives at BYU. In other words, the original is not accessible. Now, it's also possible that Brenda wrote a lot of things to Sparks that she incorporated into Go Ask Alice. Maybe Sparks composed the book from various sources. You know, her correspondence with Brenda, her talks with other teenagers, magazine articles, her own experience. But once she took one step down this path, the book is no longer a, quote, real diary, unquote. But as a social force, Go Ask Alice is absolutely real. I mean, 6 million copies is 6 million copies. It was the poster child for the war on drugs. For decades, Emerson's book gives us testimonials from celebrities talking about how Go Ask Alice was the book that kept them away from illegal drugs, as it did for doubtless countless teens. So from Sparks' point of view, Mormon, Republican, conservative, pillar of the community, the book was doubtless an unmitigated success. And it's the same with Jay's journal. Yeah, she added in the occult parts, but by gum, she was able to warn teens away from the occult just as effectively as she had warned them away from drugs. I think you and I are starting to think the same thing. Isn't it wild just how Mormon this entire scenario is? I mean, doesn't this sound like the structure of any debate about the historicity of the Book of Mormon or the Book of Abraham, just with teenagers instead of Nephites? Joseph Smith presented both books as the ancient equivalent of diaries by real people recording real events. All he did was translate them. But the more we look into these books' creation, the more oddities we find. Odd that Joseph Smith was telling Nephite stories for years before he found the golden plates. Odd that people only ever saw the golden plates in vision. Odd that the Book of Mormon theology seems to be exclusively concerned with 19th century Christian theology. Odd that when the Book of Abraham writings were found, Egyptologists identified them as run-of-the-mill funerary texts. But without a doubt, we can say that these books have impacted world history. They helped launch a religion. People crossed oceans and plains for them. People treat them as scripture. Maybe they were largely the product of Joseph Smith's mind, but they made things happen. It kind of reminds me of a speech that Greg Prince gave at a recent Sunstone symposium. He said that he'd spent some time, quote, gathering answers to three questions I often ask of church members, particularly converts. First, did you read the Book of Mormon from cover to cover? Almost invariably, the answer is something like, no, parts of it were pretty boring and I lost interest. Second, what do you remember of what you read? Not much, except that there were a lot of wars. And finally, what did you experience as you read it? Here the floodgates open, and stories of personal conversion emerge. And therein lies the timeless value of the book. What it does transcends what it is. No other aspect of Mormonism has brought more people to the convincing of the Jew and the Gentile that Jesus is the Christ. This is an important instance of the message superseding the messenger. The Book of Mormon may not be what it says it is, but it does what it says it does, which is much more important, unquote. That seems to apply just as much to Go Ask Alice and Jay's journal, except that people actually finished reading them. And just so you know, I mean that all the way down the line, both the good and the bad. I mean, we all know that Mormonism's effect on the world hasn't been all bunnies and flowers. We have plenty of racist, sexist, homophobic history under our belts, much of which we still participate in. And Jay's journal caused Alden's family no small amount of grief as their son's and their brother's memory was turned into an occult freak show. But the other interesting thing about these books is what they reveal about Sparks herself. So she and LaVorne were rich enough that they apparently bought some bookcases that had belonged to Brigham Young. And Sparks displayed her books in those bookcases, covers out, for maximum wow factor. But do you know what's in those books? Okay, I'm going to read you a few sentences from Go Ask Alice. Now, as a warning, they might set off a barrage of awkward questions from any youngsters nearby, so I'll give you a few seconds here to pause and shoo them out of the room so that they can listen raptly at the door, or you can put your earbuds in. Are you ready? We're going to go all the way, I'm just warning you. Okay, here we go. And I quote, "Another day, another blowjob. I've got a fucking head cold, and I feel miserable, and my period has started, and I don't have any Tampax. Hell, I wish I had a shot. Mighty kind of y'all. I hope you have a nice orgasm with your dog tonight." Unquote. I've got to admit, it makes me giggle to think of Brigham Young's bookcases displaying books with sentences like that in them. And that's just a small sampling. When things get bad in Alice's life, she can cuss up a storm and describe some pretty awful stuff in pretty blunt language. Now, we don't actually know what Sparks wrote and what she didn't. But the fact of the matter is, this conservative, Republican, Mormon pillar of her community put out a book with that kind of language in it. According to Emerson's book, much of the backlash against Go Ask Alice was actually from people who were probably as conservative as Sparks was, trying to ban the book and its frank sexual talk from libraries. And interestingly, their efforts almost never succeeded. Sparks was totally willing to transgress the normal boundaries of the communities she identified with to get her point across. She had kind of a wild side. Jay's journal is even more interesting because we know that she fabricated the entries dealing with the occult, whether from books, articles, interviews, or her own imagination. Here are a few examples. Once again, put your earbuds in. So here's part of his description of a drug-induced orgy. Quote, "I hit her and kicked her and mauled her. Sex was not enough. I wanted to hurt her. Tina crawled over and, gathering blood from her cuts on her fingers, she placed it in my mouth. Master, master, master," she whispered over and over. "We went through the ritual of eternal slavery to each other. Although I, the male, would always technically be the master, then we each cut our tongues and let the blood pour into each other's mouths." Unquote. Well, it's good to know the patriarchy was alive and well in Satanism during the 80s. But just think, that went through Sparks' imagination, whether she conjured it herself or assembled it from other sources. This woman had some interesting things going on in her outwardly conservative head. And then we find out that multi-level marketing really is from the devil. As Jay reports, quote, "I was absolutely and beyond belief amazed at how many occultists there are, 25 in our own school that we never dreamed about. And each one of us is obligated to bring 2 more in this year," unquote. He even talks about occultist missionaries. The question that niggles at me as I think about all this is, did Sparks know that she was lying while she wrote these books? And of course, many people have asked the same question about Joseph Smith. I'm starting to think that Joseph Smith and Beatrice Sparks had a part of their brain that was way more developed than other people's. It was the meaning-making and the narrative part of their brain. See, to them, it seems that facts were subordinate to meaning. It was stories that made facts real, not the other way around. I imagine, you know, Joseph Smith poring over the mummies and their writings and connecting them with his reading and scriptures and his own ideas, and then starting to unconsciously form a revelation of what those writings really meant. The meaning beneath the meaning that was only evident to those who had eyes to see and ears to hear, who had it revealed to them. And I can also imagine Beatrice Sparks, in a similar way, considering the pages of Alden's journal and her narrative brain, you know, first insisting that there must be more here than meets the eye, and then speculating on what might have motivated Alden that he didn't write about, and then having it come to her all at once. It was motivated by the occult. Of course he would leave that out. And now she could see its force behind his thoughts and actions, and it was everywhere. But it would be invisible to most people. And it was her job to uncover this secret motivation. People like Joseph Smith and Beatrice Sparks seem to be especially sensitive to the zeitgeist of the world around them. You know, the hopes, the fears, and the dreams. And Sparks was especially attuned to America's fears. She had a genius for gathering it up and turning it into a story that gave a shape to those fears. So her stories would both terrify and relieve her readers. It would terrify them because now they could see that their fears were true, but it would relieve them because they could finally see those fears. It's kind of like in a horror movie. The ghost loses some of its terror when it's finally revealed. You know, now that they could see the enemy, they could fight it. Of course, as Emerson points out, the reasons for the increasing teen suicide rate at the time had nothing to do with Satanism or the occult. It was much more complicated than that. But there's nothing in the world humans respond to better than a solid story with a clear antagonist to direct their lives. And I hate to say it, but that means you and me too. Think about the social issues that motivate you to action. They all have a solid story with a clear antagonist. And it's 100% certain that reality is way more complicated than that story says it is. And sadly, it's also 100% certain that although you have every good intention in the world, following that story is both helping and hurting people. So, yes, fewer teens took drugs because of Go Ask Alice. And more people suffered from mental disorders that further research into psychedelics could have relieved. The Book of Mormon helped set up an extraordinary worldwide church that helps a lot of people. But that church has also campaigned against equal rights. It's preached racism and it's protected child abusers. This basic tension was on my mind a few weeks ago when I went on a ghost tour of Provo, Utah, led by folklorist Danny Stewart. At one point, we stopped in front of a bar. Yes, Provo has bars, though this one was actually closed, where he told us some stories about a spirit that lived there. He said that he had been told that there was actually cell phone footage of a shot glass being picked up by an invisible force and thrown against the bar's wall. But no one has actually sent me the video yet, he said. So while we were walking to the next stop, I asked him, so if you did get that video, would that video be folklore, or is folklore only, like, oral? And he said, yeah, the video would be folklore. But if I wrote about this story for, like, an article or something, the video would be a very small part of it. You know, maybe a screenshot, but that's it. So I said, does that mean that the thing you value most as a folklorist is the stories themselves, not proof of their validity? And he said yes. What he was saying was that he is most interested in meaning, not data. In other words, when people tell a story, they tell it for a reason, you know, to illustrate a value they have or their concept of life. And it's the concept that's the most important part. You know, there's a spirit in the ABG bar. The video, even though it's brought up as proof, is purely ancillary, because a video is always up for question. We all know that images and video can be altered to show pretty much anything. So, apparently, folklorists, instead of chasing after the facts, chase after what humans are really interested in, meaning. But why this divorce between meaning and data? Well, I ran across John Gardner retelling an old myth about that. This is what he says. It was said in the old days that every year Thor made a circle around Middle-earth, beating back the enemies of order. Thor got older every year, and the circle occupied by gods and humans grew smaller. The wisdom god, Odin, went out to the king of the trolls, got him in an armlock, and demanded to know of him how order might triumph over chaos. "Give me your left eye," said the king of the trolls, "and I'll tell you." Without hesitation, Odin gave up his left eye. "Now tell me." The troll said, "The secret is, watch with both eyes." Odin's left eye was the last sure hope of gods and men in their kingdom of light, surrounded on all sides but darkness. All we have left is Thor's hammer, which represents not brute force, but art, unquote. As I thought through what was going on when Sparks was producing Go Ask Alice in Jay's journal, and when Joseph Smith was producing the Book of Mormon and the Book of Abraham, I realized that both of them were living in contexts where it seemed that the enemies of order were closing in. You know, the public fear of drugs, the sharply rising teen suicide rates, and in Joseph Smith's case, frontier America, on the edge of the wilderness in the grip of the Second Great Awakening. They both had the hammer of Thor, narrative art, and struck their blows with it to drive back what they perceived as the enemies of order. Now, John Gardner says that we only have Thor's hammer, but I think it's pretty clear from the myth that we just read that we also have Odin's single eye. You've probably heard me say before that, for me, we would be well served to think about myths as descriptions rather than prescriptions. In other words, to see them as describing the world rather than prescribing how we should live in it. And in this case, I think that approach is very useful. Here we have Thor's hammer, the meaning maker that drives back the enemies of order. And here we have Odin's eye, you know, the observer that perceives what's around it. Humans need both in order to make any kind of headway. We need Thor's meaning-making hammer because chaos does threaten to engulf us. Chaos frequently isn't willing to stand by and wait while we painstakingly use Odin's single eye to gather data so we know exactly where to drive the hammer blows. So usually, when we use the hammer, we do inflict violence along with meaning. And often that meaning is wrong. We can see that happening in both Sparks and Joseph Smith's cases. However, those blindly dealt narrative hammer blows do make a space that at least seems safe. Sparks took the rising teen suicide rates and attributed them to the occult, which was probably the furthest thing from the truth. However, it gave a lot of people something that felt like an orderly space so that they could start using Odin's eye to gather data. Now, a lot of the data they gathered was probably useless. Emerson shows us plenty of it. But through all that data gathering, we have reached a point where we realize that, indeed, Satanism was not the reason for rising teen suicides. It was way more complicated than that. We at least eliminated that option and saw that there was more complexity, giving us reason to look elsewhere, hopefully somewhere more useful. So it seems to me that this myth is a pretty clear description of human striving. We're constantly trying to beat back chaos. If we don't, we die. We lead out with Thor's meaning-making hammer with all its blind, dramatic destruction, and in the space that we hammer out, observation can occur, but only within this skewed space. This is why we use one-eyed Odin as our metaphor for observation. It's, I guess, the blind leading the half-blind. So, Danny Stewart, studies the blows of Thor's hammer. Scientists study the shot glass video, which may or may not exist. I think that Thor and Odin actually give us a really useful way to observe ourselves. You know, we can identify when we're being Thor, hammering out a meaning space, or participating in a community that is doing so. And we can understand that, yes, this feels necessary for the survival of something important to us. And we can also identify when we're being Odin, painstakingly observing something within that space, knowing that we are half-blind and that we are in a skewed space, if we're, you know, at least aware of these two modes. What I hope is that we'll possibly do a smidge less damage with our hammer and maybe be a smidge less slanted in our observations. So, yeah, Beatrice Sparks was Thor. She had very little Odin in her. Joseph Smith was much the same way. And look at the effect they had. As Joseph Smith predicted, their name is had for both good and evil in the world. In fact, funny thing, at the end of Unmask Alice, Emerson interviews Sparks' son, LaVorne Jr., and he says this, quote, "He opened with a disclaimer. No one knows her story, including me," unquote. Remind you of anything? "No man knows my history," Joseph Smith once said. "I cannot tell it. I shall never undertake it. I don't blame anyone for not believing my history," unquote. And I would say that Beatrice Sparks is the most Joseph Smithy person we've had in the church since, well, Joseph Smith. Hey, thanks for joining me for this kind of weird episode of the Sunstone Podcast. As a side note, I realized as I was going through all this that Sparks was actually a pioneer in Mormon literature. She was the first LDS author to reach mega literary stardom. Now, it's true that Virginia Sorensen won the Newbery Medal about 15 years before Go Ask Alice was published, but Sorensen didn't have nearly the sales that Sparks had. So before Orson Scott Card, before Stephanie Myers, before Brandon Sanderson, there was Beatrice Sparks, a fellow fiction writer. She just wasn't willing to admit it. And I think it's absolutely true that she wouldn't have had nearly the success or the social impact if she had. Well, on that little thought, I'm going to bow out for the week. We'll catch you next time.